Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled, Why Our New President Should Think Local First. We want to welcome all of our audience here this evening and invite you to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many, many fine program events which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. Michael Schumann is Vice President for Enterprise Development for the Training and Development Corporation, TDC. He's an economist, an attorney, an author, and an entrepreneur. He has authored, co-authored, or edited 7 books, including The Small Mart Revolution, How Local Businesses Are Beating the Global Competition, and also Going Local, Creating Self-Reliant Communities in the Global Age. Schumann is helping to lead development of TDC's WorkSphere program, a national effort to support worker well-being through a variety of programs promoting sustainable employability and global community capitalism. He received an AB with distinction in economics and international relations from Stanford University and a JD from Stanford Law School. He talks frequently on this subject matter. He's given an average of more than one invited talk per week for over 25 years throughout the United States and the world. He lives in the Washington, D.C. area. Please join me in welcoming Michael Schumann.
Thank you, Tom, and thank all of you for coming after such a interesting 24 hours that we've just had. We clearly are at the precipice of quite a historical moment. We have elected the first black man ever in the United States as president after the worst economic debacle of the last 3 generations. And we are in the midst of a war which is one of the longest wars in our history. Ever since the United States started keeping tabs on whether or not the American public believes we are on the right or the wrong track, we are at the lowest moment since that recording began. Clearly, the hard part now for a President Barack Obama is governance. In a sense, getting elected was the easy part. We are lucky, I believe, that we have elected a community organizer. The challenge, though, is the paradox is that here is a community organizer who not once in the campaign talked about community organizing. So we don't have a good sense, nor did we have one from John McCain, about what exactly they would do in the service of America's communities. I believe that we have to look deeper, because ultimately the solution to America's economic crisis, I would argue, lies in solving our community crises. And I must say that it is not entirely encouraging that the lead economic advisor for Barack Obama is Jason Furman, whose most famous paper claimed the great progressive values of the company Walmart. There is an exceptional moment in the campaign where there was, I think, some interesting discussion about the candidates' positions. About 2 weeks ago, on one of the main news programs, Senator John Kyle of Arizona, representing the McCain campaign, and Senator Evan Bayh of Indiana, representing the Obama campaign, went at it about the 2 philosophies about competitiveness in the world. What I found interesting about the discussion is that both candidates' representatives claimed that competitiveness was about who could do a better job of attracting and retaining footloose corporations. No one, including on the Obama side, argued that the key for prosperity was focusing on rooted, locally owned businesses. And I believe that is a huge mistake. This, unfortunately, is true for U.S. economic development policy writ large. Over the last 2 years, I've been doing a study for the Kellogg Foundation looking at 15 states. Unfortunately, California is not one of them. But we've been looking at the three largest economic development programs in those states, looking at 2 or 3 years of activity in those programs. And the question we asked was simple. What percentage of the money in each of these 88 program years spread over the 15 states, what percentage of the money is going to locally owned business? The shocking answer is that in only 8 program years, that is 10% of the economic development that we looked at, was a majority of the money, a simple majority of the money going to locally owned business. In 90% of the program years, nearly all of the money was going to non-local business. So economic development today, what is going on at the grassroots level to create jobs, to create prosperity, to prevent crisis, is largely about the attraction or retention of non-local business. This is a terrible mistake, and I will explain why in a few moments. But it is worthwhile to say that there is an alternative. And that alternative, the title of tonight's talk, is Think Local First. Local First has been the clarion call of networks of businesses around the United States. And the idea of Think Local First is that we should encourage people to find great deals from locally owned businesses wherever possible. Now, I was one of the people sitting in a room about 6 years ago as we were thinking about what slogan to choose on all of this, and we came up with Think Local First after a lot of very careful consideration. Notice that the slogan is not buy local. The slogan is not buy local irrespective of the cost. The slogan is not buy local or you suck. The slogan is think local first. The idea is that we want people to be more careful shoppers. But it's not just about shopping. It's about taking every element of our economy, the planning, the investment, the building of business networks, the public policy pieces, and retargeting all of that around locally own businesses. Why is this so important? Well, if I were Barack Obama, I would look at today's crises, the big crises that he has spent the last 2 years on the campaign trail arguing furiously about, and see in each of these crises the seeds of opportunity. The opportunities can only come through the expansion of local business. For example, we have rising oil prices. Oil prices, the chart that I am showing you right now indicates that the price of oil has increased from, in 1998, about $10, $11 a barrel, peaked this past summer at $150 a barrel, and is now back down to about $60, $70 a barrel. But we know that the price of oil is going to continue to steadily rise. I mean, there will be bumps of ups and downs. This is bad news for people on limited incomes, people who drive a lot for their jobs. But at the end of the day, this is great news for local economies. It's great news because we're going to be doing a lot of household, business-to-business energy efficiency. That's an inherently local activity. We're going to be doing more smart growth, creating walkable communities. We're going to be using our non-local cars, much less. And local production, linked with local distribution, is going to become more cost-effective than Walmart production linked with stores 15,000 miles away. A second example of where crisis also reveals opportunity is climate change. Climate disruption is clearly upon us. We see it in the melting of the ice caps. We see it in the change of the weather. We see it in increasing spreads of disease and other vectors like insect vectors. But at the end of the day, we know that the solution for the energy crisis lies in a local activity, the creation of a new generation of local micropower. It's been a remarkably vapid energy debate over the last few months in the presidential campaign. We had, on the one hand, John McCain arguing that we needed to build a crash program of 45 nuclear power plants, and the candidate who was against corporate welfare nevertheless was prepared to guarantee, with $300 billion additional dollars, the building of those plants. These plants, if built, actually would have had just a capital cost that would be greater than the price of electricity that we get out of wind machines built today. Barack Obama chose not to really engage in the energy debate and has said, well, we need to keep all of our options open. What I believe is the appropriate energy policy is doing the best things first. In fact, only focusing on the things that are cost effective. And what we know is that micropower, cogeneration, wind power, photovoltaic electricity, solar thermal electricity, are going to be the cost-effective options of the very near future. And we already know, by the way, that 100 by 100 miles square of the Arizona desert with today's inefficient photovoltaic cells would be enough to generate all the electricity we consume in the United States each year. We know that the wind resource in the United States is twice the existing demand of electricity in this country. We know that cogeneration has a capacity to totally displace nuclear power at a fraction of the existing cost. These are local energy alternatives waiting to happen. A third crisis in which there are seeds of opportunity, the shrinking dollar. Now, the dollar has had a bounce back against a few currencies in the last year, but generally, the dollar has shrunk. And it will continue to shrink because we have an enormous trade deficit. This is bad news, again, for some parts of the U.S. economy. But the good thing about a shrinking dollar is that imports become more expensive and exports become more lucrative. And so many of the industries that we have sent abroad, or more accurately, that we have let go of, have encouraged to go abroad, we'll come back to that a little bit later, these industries can and should come back to the United States if we are careful about nurturing a new generation of local production. A final crisis, fourth and final crisis, in which there are seeds of opportunity, the financial crisis. Say what you will about the causes of the financial crisis, fraud, overzealous selling, deregulation of certain kinds of banks, corruption within Fannie Mae. There's a whole list of culprits. But at the end of the day, I believe there are two fundamental things that we have done in our financial sector that are responsible. And both are around one idea. We have delinked finance from place. And that is a huge mistake. First of all, we have allowed a growing number of banks to give loans to and give predatory loans, and then we encourage those banks to resell those loans on secondary markets. And then they go back and do more of those loans with fresh capital. These predatory loans, in a sense, were thrown at the American public on a steady basis, and then the non-local banks kick them out of the community. So you do it, and then you run away from those debts, and you do it faster. Now, it's interesting that the banks that were not involved in the predatory loans, by and large, were local credit unions and local banks. And after the financial crisis, these are the last institutions standing. There's a lesson in that for us. Another feature is that these exotic instruments that we created to move mortgages onto secondary markets, sometimes derivatives, sometimes things that you can't even pronounce, these instruments are largely about playing a game of telephone with the American public. That is, you have some information about risk, and that risk is contained in some financial instrument that you sell. And then there's communication with the sale of that risk, sale of that instrument to another party and another party and another party. And like the game of telephone, as you go through more of these parties, the information that you're supposed to have about the risk is totally lost. And that is an inherent feature of global finance. It is very difficult to keep tabs on information about real risk. If we bring finance back to communities where we can actually look at, inspect, have a relationship with those people or businesses that we are investing in, we will be able to bring those risks way down. I think one of the most encouraging things that has happened over the last few years in the face of these crises is the emergence of a local living economy movement embodied in an organization based here in San Francisco, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, or BALI. And BALI has espoused a philosophy that is basically about three ideas. The first is the most successful economy will be the one that has the highest degree of local ownership. Second, the most successful economy will be one that is, on the one hand, as self-reliant as possible, and on the other hand, as engaged in the global economy as possible. One of the mistakes that economic developers have made is the assumption that if you just focus on the global side of the picture, the local side will take care of itself. When in fact, most of the evidence that we have in economic development says that the causality works in exactly the opposite direction. That if you focus on local businesses, some critical mass of them will naturally begin to sell their goods and services to a global market. You don't need to subsidize them in advance to do so. The final idea in BALI is that we believe in socially responsible business, businesses with high labor and environmental standards. BALI now has about 70 networks in the United States. These networks formally represent 15,000 businesses, but if you really count all the local businesses in their jurisdiction, we're talking about several million businesses. This is one of the fastest growing movements in the United States. And to me, it is stunning that a community organizer who is now president has not once acknowledged this movement. What I'd like to talk about in the next 25, 30 minutes or so is to really share with you what is the strengthening case for local living economies. And then I want to say a little bit about some of the emerging strategies that we're seeing around the country for local living economies. Why are local living economies becoming so clearly the strategy that we ought to use for economic development? Another way of phrasing this question is, why is it that locally owned businesses clearly perform better in promoting economic development than non-locally owned businesses? I want to give you three reasons why this is true, and then we can just talk through a bunch of other reasons that I don't have time to get into. The first is that locally owned businesses don't move. They don't have ambitions for moving to Mexico or Malaysia. Well, that tends to go to their reliability. And a great example of this comes from a study that was done from a newspaper in Oregon about 5 years ago, looking at the economic development policies out of Lane County, Oregon, over about a five-year period. And the head of economic development there, a fellow named Jack Roberts, had spent 5 years giving out several million dollars of tax abatements. What the newspaper found was that 95% of his tax abatements went to six non-local businesses. Three came, took the benefits, and after a year or two shut down and moved abroad. Two came, took the benefits, but never delivered the jobs that they promised, and one was more or less on target. The other 5% of the tax abatement money went to about 100 locally owned businesses. These businesses made very modest job promises and essentially delivered on the promises they made. The bottom line was stunning. In tax abatement terms, the cost of a job from a locally owned business was $2,000. The cost of all the jobs that were generated from the non-locally owned businesses was $22,000. But remember, some of those jobs came and went, so you have to look at it in net job terms. And in net terms, the cost of a job from a non-local business was $67,000. It was more than 30 times more expensive to get a job from a non-local business. A second feature of local businesses is that they spend more of their money locally. And this has profound implications for economic development. There was a wonderful study done in Austin, Texas, about 6 years ago by a group called Civic Economics, looking at the relative impact of $100 spent at a local bookstore versus $100 spent at a Borders. $100 spent at the local bookstore led to $45 staying in the local economy. $100 spent at the Borders, $13. Roughly speaking, every time you buy the exact same book at the local bookstore, you get three times the jobs in the community, three times the income and the wealth effects, three times the tax collections. We're not talking about small potatoes of difference here. Why was there that difference? Well, the Borders didn't have a high-level management team on the ground. The local bookstore did. The Borders did not advertise on local radio and TV. The local bookstore did. The Borders did not use business services like lawyers and accountants. The local bookstore did. The Borders did not have a stream of profits coming into the community. The local bookstore did. Just those four line items could easily be 25, 30, 35% of the expenditures of a business. So you would see it would truly be an unusual comparison where you would get a higher economic multiplier from the non-local business. There have been more than a dozen studies that have been done on this question over the last 10 years. The numbers vary a little bit from study to study, but they all point in the same direction. Local businesses contribute 2 to 4 times as much to economic development for every dollar spent as do non-local businesses. Here's a study that I did in Detroit about a year and a half ago. Detroit, as you know, is a city that was built for 2 million people. It now has under 1 million people. The grassroots in Detroit have done something really very exciting, which is that they're becoming farmers, and they're taking over vast tracts of abandoned land and converting them into food-growing farms. Well, I was interested in the question, suppose we were to shift 20% of Detroiters' food expenditure from non-local food to Detroit-grown. just that one act would create 5,000 jobs in the city. Suppose you got the five surrounding counties in the Detroit region to do the same thing in the name of regional solidarity. That 20% shift would create more than 40,000 jobs. This one act of localization could be the most significant economic development policy ever to hit the Motor City. And yet, it's totally off the radar screen of public officials there in Detroit. The third distinct advantage of locally owned businesses comes from the fact that most of their spending is local. When their spending is local, it means that the inputs that come into the business are local too. And local inputs means less shipping, less transportation, less of a carbon footprint. Now, there have been some cutesy studies that one finds in mainstream newspapers that claim that, well, local businesses, local consumption, local food, that's sometimes good for reducing our carbon footprint, but it's not always the case. There, for example, was an op-ed in the New York Times two summers ago where the author said, there is now a study in the United Kingdom circulating around that shows that if you eat local lamb in Britain, that lamb will contain four times the carbon as lamb that's imported from New Zealand. Well, who did this study? It turned out this study was commissioned by the New Zealand Lamb Export Association. And the study never looked at local lamb. It compared badly done non-local lamb in New Zealand, which had lots of inputs coming, you know, supported by electricity, and the electricity was generated by clean hydropower. So these were green bionic lambs. And then in the United Kingdom, you had lambs that had electricity inputs coming into the feeds and other things, and the electricity was generated by coal. So these were dirty bionic lambs. But they never looked at locally produced and consumed lamb at all. And really, when you scratch beneath the surface of most of these studies, you find that they have not really done a serious job at looking at the carbon footprint of locally owned businesses and local production. There have been a few studies in this country that are taking a serious look at this. In the University of Washington, about a year and a half ago, there was an analysis of two plates of food. The plates contained salmon, fruit, potatoes, vegetables. One was from a local source. One was from a non-local source. And they found that the non-local plate had, no surprise, 50% more carbon associated with it than the local plate. Now, there are a bunch of other advantages to local living economies. Locally owned businesses tend to be more sustainable. They tend to promote tourism. They are consistent with Richard Florida's arguments about a creative economy. They encourage contact and relationships in the marketplace, which are good for civil society. There are sociology studies that suggest that communities made up largely of locally owned businesses have higher degrees of social equality. And there's political science literature that suggests that these communities have higher degrees of voting participation. Those are a lot of benefits that one gets from locally owned businesses. Now, what I would like to do is to turn to the question of how ought we to promote local living economies. And I believe that an agenda ought to consist of six P's: planning, people, partners, purse, by which I mean investing, purchasing, and policy making. And I want to just walk through a couple of examples of each of these very quickly to give you an idea of what this agenda might look like. So let's start with planning. How would one undertake a new generation of economic planning that focused on local businesses? Well, it turns out that the key thing we want to do here is plug the leaks. That is, we want to look at all of the places where a local economy is unnecessarily importing goods and services from outside the community, because those are opportunities for new or expanded local business. I've done some work with a half dozen communities in trying to measure leakages. The longest standing effort was in upstate New York in St. Lawrence County. St. Lawrence County is the biggest landmass county in New York State, has about 100,000 people, and it's one of the poorest counties in New York State. We organized several hundred people in the county into teams around different sectors of the economy, teams like food and agriculture, education, energy, health, manufacturing. And I encouraged the teams to do a serious study of what they would view as progress in their sector, what were the assets that the county had that could be used for new or expanded local businesses, and what were the leakages. I provided them with some of the critical information that they needed to do this kind of grassroots analysis. For example, in assets of labor, land, and capital, I pointed out to them that because of recent bankruptcies of farms, there were 250,000 acres of vacant farmland. There were 3,700 people in the community who were un or underemployed. There was $1 billion in local banks and credit unions, which in theory could be invested in local business, and I estimated another $5 billion in pension funds that people had that could be tapped for local business. One of the things that Tom Waller did not say about me in my introduction is that I've been very interested in developing a small-scale chicken company on the eastern shore of Maryland, Bay Friendly Chicken. So I was very interested and remain interested in the concept of meat leakages. I know there's some vegetarians here, so my apologies. But in St. Lawrence County, in this county that fancies itself, we are number one in dairy. They are importing 11,000 beef cows a year. They're importing 36,000 pigs worth of bacon. They're more or less self-reliant on a small amount of lamb. And most stunningly, they are importing 2 million chickens. So I sat down with the Food and Ag Group and said, okay, let's think this through. You have got 250,000 acres of unused farmland. You've got 3,700 people unemployed. You've got $6 billion of potentially usable capital, and you are importing 2 million chickens. Does anyone see a business opportunity here? Well, this was the kind of logic that we did in all of the teams. And if we flash forward 6 years, no, sadly, they have not done the chicken business. But they have set up an energy service company that is plugging energy leaks. They have a farm-to-school program that is taking those dairy products and selling them to local schools, universities, and that other great local institution, the prison. They have a carp tournament where thousands of Brits descend on St. Lawrence County each year to fish out the carp, and they've built up local hotels and restaurants to support this tourist industry. They train local manufacturers how to promote their goods on eBay more effectively. And in some cases, the graduates of this program have been able to increase the sales for their home-based businesses 10 or 100-fold a month. Now, to talk about four of the other P's, I want to introduce another concept that I think is very important for economic development, and that is a concept of meta-business. Economic development today is largely about begging for money. And it's one reason why it is very hard to change course, because it's all a system of one guy paying another guy for certain kinds of economic development. It seems ironic that a profession that professes to want to promote entrepreneurship is itself so non-entrepreneurial. And I believe that the local living economy movement is demonstrating how, in fact, economic development can be done in an entrepreneurial way. Let me give you an example. Bellingham, Washington, a community north of Seattle with 100,000 people, they have a Bali network there that every year produces a coupon book. The coupon book has 600-700 businesses with coupons in there. If you use all of those coupons, you save probably $7,000-$8,000. This is the best-selling book in the local bookstore. And this economic development project, let's call it what it is, it's an economic development project, pays for itself. In fact, it might soon make money. Now, isn't that an interesting concept? Isn't there something there for economic developers to learn from? I call this a meta-business because it's a business, a coupon book, that is supporting a whole bunch of locally owned businesses and doing so in a way that is going to, over time, make money. There are a lot of ideas and experiments out there on how one can make money promoting economic development. So let's think about meta-businesses around purchasing, around Think Local First. There are local debit and credit cards. The Locals Care Card in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which gives bonus points every time you spend it at a locally owned business. This card is now carried by 1 out of 10 residents of Santa Fe. This card has made the local bank in Santa Fe that started it, Los Alamos Savings, move from number 4 in the region to number 1 as people have moved their money into the local bank to support the local debit card. There are local gift cards that introduce people, you know, starting at their, say, stockings and Christmas time to a whole range of new local businesses. There are business-to-business midwife agencies. A great example of this was called the Oregon Marketplace. The Oregon Marketplace thrived for 15 years in the 1980s and early 1990s. And they basically went to businesses throughout Oregon, saw where they were getting their inputs from production, and then resourced those inputs to local businesses in Oregon. And then they took finder's fees out of the new contracts, and they were able to pay their way. Business alliances also offer opportunities for meta-businesses. In a sense, the Bali networks are about alliances of local businesses that realize, you know something, if we work together, we can become more competitive. We have to change the way we do business and not just view one another with suspicion as competitors down the street. So here are some examples. In Tucson, Arizona, there is a business network that is involved in joint procurement. The network is called Tucson Originals. These are businesses involved in food, restaurants, food production, and they buy foodstuffs and plates and kitchen equipment collectively, and thereby bring down costs. There are groups of businesses that are putting together commercial shopping malls. Now, we're in an era right now where a lot of big box malls are soon going to be empty because we have hundreds of big box firms that are in bankruptcy, and many of these malls are not going to make it. The one thing that could help them make it would be to start bringing local businesses together to occupy those malls. These are spaces that with creative commercial development can start to be hubs of communities. And a picture I have on the screen, for those who can't see it, is of Pike's Market in Seattle, a great example of a destination mostly made up of locally owned businesses. Another thing that local businesses could do together is delivery. This picture here is of the CEO of Small Potatoes Urban Delivery, or SPUD. SPUD is a small company in Vancouver, British Columbia. They will deliver 300 varieties of fresh fruits and vegetables to your door in biofueled vehicles. Now, I would like this guy to get involved not only in delivery of food, but delivery of diapers. I was home about a year ago with two young kids alone, single parenthood, and at about 10 o'clock at night, I realized I was a man without diapers. I would have paid the CEO of Spud $100 to bring me a single diaper. Now, I am sure I am not alone. There are all kinds of people who can't get out of the house. Single parents, the disabled, the elderly. Local businesses have a huge untapped market in direct delivery to those individuals. Amazon says they'll get you a book in 24 hours. We need a local delivery system that will get you a book from the local bookstore in 24 minutes. Let's talk about some investment that meta businesses. We can create credit unions as a way of restoring the credit universe for small businesses. We can create community loan funds. One example of a great community loan fund involves a delicatessen owner named Frank in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. About 15 years ago, Frank's son had cancer. He was nearly destitute, and then he lost his lease. He needed several tens of thousands of dollars to move his company to another site. He didn't know how he was going to do it. Well, working with the E.F. Schumacher Society, he created what became known as Deli Dollars, Deli Bonds. He took $9 today from his customers and agreed to pay them $10 in food 6, 9, 12 months down the road. So these became bonds with very attractive payout rates. Well, what was remarkable is that he sold all the bonds he needed to immediately, got the money, was able to move his lease, move to a new building, has been very successful since then. But what also started to happen is that these deli dollars went into circulation. People started to use their deli dollars for the movies, or they started to use them at restaurants or use them for services. And it starts to show that there's a very close linkage between credit and money. And if we are very clever at the local level, even when the credit system is totally broken, through little tools like this, we can start to create our own credit and our own money and wean our economies back to life. Another example of creative economic development at the grassroots level is local stock. Stock that can only be owned by people living within a state. When Ben & Jerry's stock was first issued, you had to be a resident of Vermont to buy it. Unfortunately, they let go of that in subsequent stock issues, and Ben & Jerry's got hastily taken over by Unilever. But the concept was an interesting one. And here's an example of a community that used it to create another small business, the Mercantile, the Merc, in Powell, Wyoming. People in Powell needed a place to buy socks and underwear. They were too small to attract a chain store to come in, so they said, you know what? We're gonna create our own general merchandise store. They needed $1 million. So they created their own stock issue and sold the stock door to door like Girl Scout cookies. They got their money together, and this thing was profitable in year one and has been profitable ever since. There are a half dozen other communities in the Rocky Mountain states that now have their own Mercs, and it has demonstrated the concept of local stock as a form of financing local business. One of the things that I've done when I go speak around the country is I ask people, how many of you bank locally? And usually most hands go up in the air. When I then ask the question, how many of you have your pension funds and local business, all of the hands go down. Now, this is shocking. It's shocking because half of the private economy is small local business. Half of the competitive private economy is local small business. And yet, almost none of our retirement savings are going into those businesses. That is a total market failure. And the solution for that failure at the end of the day is local stock. Now, it's not enough to create local stock. We need to create markets for local stock. And will, for example, a Northern California Stock Exchange exist with a big floor like the New York Stock Exchange? I don't think so. At the end of the day, it's going to be a virtual exchange, looking more like Prosper.com or Kiva.org. This also suggests a meta-business for entrepreneurship. There are 1,000 incubators in North America that are nurturing small businesses, and the businesses that come out of these incubators have pretty good survival rates. So we know something about how to make business incubators work. The downside of all of this is that most of these incubators depend on foundation or government money. They're not self-financing. Well, how do you get these businesses to self-finance? Well, one thing you could do is you could say, okay, well, we're gonna put a debt on you upon graduation. You pay $200,000 back to the incubator for all the services we've given you for 2 years or whatever. Well, that would really hurt the business. So a smarter thing to do would be to create a local stock issue around that business during the 2 years of incubation, and the incubator then keeps the stock, 5 or 10% of the stock, just like Goldman Sachs does, and then gradually sells that stock out to the community to finance the next stage of incubation. Now, the last thing I just want to mention briefly, because I know my time is limited and I want to leave some time for questions, is what would a public policy agenda look like under the Obama administration supportive of these ideas? Well, one thing we might do is we might supply people with better data at the community level so that people could measure what the degree of leakage out of their economy was, especially in the financial sector. We might get the U.S. government to selectively buy locally made goods and services and pass a piece of legislation at the national level that said that local procurement was not a violation of the Interstate Commerce Clause. We might have securities reforms at the national level that gave a waiver from the SEC for any small security offerings. I would say for any business under $250,000, if people want to buy up to $100 worth of stock in there, there should not be any legal rigmarole. Those businesses should not be required to invest $50 or $100,000 in unnecessary legal filings. We should create tax credits to support local business investment. This is one of the good things that Barack Obama has talked about. He has talked about a 20% tax credit for anyone who puts money in rural-based microbusinesses. Those of you who are sitting in the audience here can see that I have a picture of Joe the plumber up here because, instead of talking about, like, who is going to be affected by taxes, whether it would be Joe or not Joe, whether it would be this small business or the other small business, what was never talked about was how tax credits in the Obama plan could actually be of benefit to all kinds of local businesses. This could be a revolution in local business. I don't think we should just put this kind of tax credit on rural businesses. It should be across the board to all kinds of local businesses. And this would then wake up the investment community and wake up the lawyer community to figure out new ways of easing these various securities laws and make local investment of our pension funds possible. Everything that I have mentioned to you costs a little bit of money. But it doesn't cost much money. It doesn't cost much money to start meta-businesses that are self-financing. And it doesn't cost much money to change the regulatory approach to securities. It doesn't cost much money to put into effect a very modest tax credit. What stands in the way right now is we are wasting more than 90% of our money on the attraction or retention of non-local business. We have to convince President Obama to put an end to that kind of wasteful economic development and focus the dollars laser-like on the modest, cheap reforms that I have outlined here. Where I want to leave you is with this photo, this picture, which comes from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Those of you who remember this great number three movie in the series may recall that Indiana had gone through all kinds of tests. He had suffered through snakes and spiders, terrorists, people with flying blades, and he finally comes to a crypt. And in this crypt is the Holy Grail. Guarding the crypt is a 500-year-old guy. And the 500-year-old guardian says, "Indiana, your last task will be to choose from among these 50 goblets. You must choose which goblet Christ drank from. Choose wisely." Well, at that point, the German spy jumps to the front and says, "Ah, I know which one Christ would have drunk from. It would have been the most ornate." And he drinks from the goblet and spontaneously combusts. The guardian then says, "He chose poorly." What I would argue is that we are all choosing poorly. We are not choosing local first. We are not doing the economic planning necessary for local first. We are not buying local first. We're not investing local first. We're not undertaking the public policies in support of local first. This is what a President Obama can fix. And if we are in a revolutionary mindset with a revolutionary new kind of president, I suggest we listen to the revolutionary wisdom of Patrick Henry with just one little amendment. "Why stand we here idle? Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me community or give me death." Thank you very much.
I want to thank Michael Schumann for his remarks tonight, rather provocative and also, I think, heightening awareness around perhaps something that we have been conditioned over time to not give so much thought to. And I say conditioned because it seems to me this whole notion of globalization and all the wonderful benefits of globalization, of economies of scale and wider choice and so forth and so on. So I guess my leadoff question would be to just address some of these yeah buts associated with the globalization thing. And you know, yeah, but what about wider choice of products and services? Yeah, but what about the perhaps longer operating hours or open longer and so forth that perhaps these non-local companies with the deep pockets might afford in terms of their local stores? Just touch on some of those, if you would, for a few minutes.
Sure. So it's interesting that the framework of your question was around stores. And I think as we think about the possible competitiveness of local businesses, we say, "Oy, how could it happen? Walmart's here, Home Depot, Office Depot, and you start running through these lists of chain stores. What we forget is that all of these things are retail. And retail is only 7% of our economy. And it's true that retail stores have taken a shellacking over the last decade. no question about it, although in some ways that shellacking is reversing. And for example, bookstores, local bookstores, finally saw the first year of expansion last year, and I think we're going to see that in a bunch of other local businesses. But in the other 93% of business activity, local businesses are doing pretty well. And so part of the challenge of promoting local first is to think beyond retail, to think of all these home-based businesses and small-scale manufacturing and small-scale finance businesses and small-scale steel production, small-scale textiles. These are all areas where local businesses, small businesses, are finding a new level of competitiveness.
Okay. So really, the as you say, the overemphasis perhaps on the retail is what I'm hearing, and that we've got all these other categories of business to think about. What questions from our audience, please?
I recently read an article in the New York Times Magazine by Michael Pollan. I don't know if you read it, but he was talking about farming and doing locally grown food. That's something I'm very interested in. And he was saying that in order to do this, we have to have a lot more people going into farming and growing locally grown vegetables. And as I thought about it, I was thinking, well, how could you possibly pay the cost and employ farmers and pay them a decent salary in order for them to do this kind of work? I think if they could get a decent amount of money, then they might be more attracted, but I couldn't figure out how they would possibly do something like that. Do you have a thought about it?
Yes, great question. And actually, the question fits hand in glove with the previous question from Tom, because food nicely illustrates why it is that local business is a lot more competitive than we think. Global production, large-scale production, often leads to great economies of scale. But what has not been appreciated is that national and global distribution has become extremely inefficient. If you look at food, back in the year 1900, when a dollar was spent on a foodstuff at a market, something like 40 cents went to the farmer. The rest went to inputs and marketing. Today, when a dollar goes for food, about 7 cents reaches the farmer. 73 cents goes to marketing. And by marketing, I mean packaging, refrigeration, transportation, advertising, middle people, things that have nothing to do with food. Whenever you have a distribution number that's very large and a production number that's very small, there is an opportunity for reorganizing it around local distribution, getting rid of most of that crapola around global distribution, and giving more money to the farmers and lowering costs for the consumers. And I'll give you another example of how this occurred. I have a friend who lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan, loves fresh salmon. He decided to organize 100 of his neighbors to buy a shipment of fresh salmon every week from a fisher person in the Pacific Northwest. What they found is that by bypassing the mainstream distribution system, they were able to put 4 times as much money per pound into the pocket of that fisher person at half the price that Fresh Foods, Whole Foods, was charging them. And so that is the underlying philosophy of how we're going to be able to help small farmers make a go of it. Now, you know, whether or not the scale, the right scale for local farming is small or, you know, medium scale, we're still going to have to work that through. But I am very optimistic that local food at the end of the day, particularly as oil prices go up and transportation of things that are mostly water gets to be really expensive, that we're gonna see a lot more local food.
First of all, thank you so much for coming. I really enjoyed your talk. I really enjoy your book, too. So everybody should go out there and buy it.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to go back to a comment you made earlier about mortgage lending and going back to sort of a local mortgage lending system. And I wanted to push back a little bit on that, mostly because I think that I completely agree with you. It's going to improve. It's going to improve underwriting standards. I think it's going to. It's likely going to ensure that the folks who do end up getting mortgages are not going to default, which I think is happening to a certain extent now. But if you decouple the local mortgage lenders from the capital markets, I think you're going to see a significant increase in the cost of capital, which is likely going to offset the gains from the improved underwriting standards. So even if you are able to tap local capital, which is something you advocated for, I'm concerned that fewer people are going to be able to buy homes as a consequence, which could have an adverse effect on neighborhood stability. So,
yeah, you know, it's a good question. And I would just say that there are no simple answers to this, because I could point to a number of examples of very, very successful local banks, local credit unions. I could point to a regional chain in Maine, Bangor Savings, which do not sell their loans on a secondary market and have done very well. On the other hand, Your larger point is correct, that there is an advantage for banks to sell their loans on the secondary market, to get new capital coming in and being able to offer more capital. And maybe what we need ultimately is some kind of compromise. I see the compromise as creating perhaps regional or intrastate secondary markets so that banks within a state would sell their loans, package their loans, but simply in bonds that would circulate in-state, perhaps in-state pension funds would purchase. And, you know, at the end of the day, we could create these sort of intrastate markets and then link them with other kinds of financial instruments. And I view it as, you know, Way back when I was learning how to use computers for the first time, there were like these big machines. I mean, I'm dating myself here, but big machines, like one airline reservation machine based in Timbuktu. And when that thing went down, the whole airline system went down. Well, what happened was, and became much smarter, was the creation of regional and local nodes that had a light system of interconnection. And that kind of goal is, I think, what we want in finance. We want regional nodes of capital moving around. We want a light sense of interconnection among those things. But you want each region to be sufficiently self-reliant so that when one of those regions goes down, it doesn't pull the whole system down again with it.
Each business that you talk about, I see many advantages to going local, as you speak of, whether it be farming, whether it be finance, whether it be even airlines you mentioned. And it seems that what's going through my mind is the basic battle is going against the inherent efficiencies of a centralized management without the overlap, which is what we're battling. But it seems like the answer to that would be local collaborations, is what it seems. So what do you see as the best means of encouraging the local collaborations, no matter what the business? Is it legislation, advocacy, say, hey, in the long run, we're going to come out? What do you see as the best tools?
Well, the single best tool for promoting local collaboration, fortunately, does not involve government money. It can be done just through grassroots self-organization, and that is to become a network affiliated with the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, or BALI. BALI makes it really easy for you to do this. You just log into their website, www.livingeconomies.org. There are people who will help you organize networks, and BALI really works on the principle that local businesses are the most important agents for change in a community. local businesses working together have credibility that activists do not, that public policy people do not. They are very pragmatic. They're not ideological. And they understand that when they can figure out real ways of working together, doing joint marketing, say through a Local First campaign, joint borrowing, joint contracting through, say, a farm-to-school program, that they actually can improve their individual standing and their collective standing. So really, I think that's what I would encourage you to do. Organize a local business alliance. There are local business alliances throughout the Bay Area. This is one of the hotbeds of activity, as one would expect. But increasingly, it's happening in rural communities, too. Just 2 days ago, I was speaking up in Siskiyou County, right on the border of California and Oregon. And there are business alliances that are forming up there in towns that have several hundred people. So I think people are understanding that the right response to distress is to bring businesses together and protect their collective and community well-being.
Michael, along those lines, we have reached the point where, unfortunately, our time is running short. I wondered if you'd just take a couple of moments to summarize for us the one or two big things you'd like to leave us with in terms of perhaps this local initiative around business alliance is one of them. But just anyway, what would you have us leave here with in terms of either how to think or what to do going forward?
Right. So I guess two things I would like to leave you with, which we sort of have talked around. The first is that localization is often burlesqued as a way that rich people can exotically spend more money to, you know, support their nice organic food, local food, whatever habits. And I just want to say outright that this is a tremendous misunderstanding of what's going on out there. That actually local businesses, local goods and services are increasingly competitive. And as oil prices go up, shipping around the world is going to go down. As economic and financial crises worsen, we're going to see a lot more competitiveness of local banking and local pension funds. As we see climate change grow worse, we're going to see more movement towards local electrical utilities. So I just feel like there are many trends out there that are presenting us with more affordable goods and services. And smart localization should be seen as a way of putting more money into individuals' pockets and into communities' pockets. I think the second point that I want to leave you with is that economic development, and all of us live in communities with economic development programs at the local, county, and state level, also at the national level. Economic developers have espoused a philosophy that says we should do absolutely everything to create jobs. Big businesses, little businesses, clean businesses, dirty businesses, prison businesses, free business. If they create jobs, we'll take them. This is really dumb. It's especially dumb because we know that one kind of business is a huge job generator compared to another kind of business. And that is locally owned small businesses are generating 60 to 80% of the new jobs in our economy. And all of these other businesses, these global businesses that the competaholics talk about in terms of we need to throw billions of dollars their way for attraction or retention, this has nothing to do with economic development. It has nothing to do with community development. It has a lot to do with a system of pork in place that we really need to disassemble. So I would encourage you to take these ideas to your economic developers and encourage them to support local, micro, small businesses, and to remember that every dollar spent on attracting or retaining a non-local business is a dollar unavailable for supporting the businesses we know are much better for our well-being.
I want to thank Michael Schumann, who's been talking to us about, in some very creative and provocative ways, about the importance of emphasizing the local business development. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened environment and discussions, is now adjourned. Thank you very much.